Good morning, everybody. This is Bio241. It is October 2nd. We're going to start cell respiration and metabolism today, but we got to finish up some things in enzymes and energy, and I'll review just a little bit some enzymes and energy chapter. And let's see, here we are looking at the schedule. So we're going to have two lectures this week on metabolism and then a bunch of lectures on nervous system and even autonomic nervous system. But autonomic nervous system is not on the next test. Next test is the 23rd. So it's just going to be chapters 4, 5, and 7 on the next exam coming up. They're not really cumulative, but you can't really forget anything that you learn in the class, like so many other classes. Okay. So does anybody have any questions on enzymes and energy? I don't see any questions. Maybe I'll turn some of these lights off. See if I get the microphone to behave. Nice. Okay, I think that's the best I can do. Okay, so you got a bunch of questions within the chapter, at the end of the chapter, and online questions. And one of the questions that I think repeats itself in a couple of those locations has to do with enzyme activity. So there's a bunch of points that you should be aware of when it comes to an enzyme, what it does and how it functions inside the cell. And one is a concept of energy. So if we look at this graph over here, actually before I close this off, does anybody have a question on the schedule at all? I think we're pretty set with the schedule. So let me make the schedule go away. Okay, so here we have some graphs. And here's my cursor. Here we have some graphs of energy versus reaction time. Right here we have reactants, and we have this reaction taking place under two kinds of conditions, without the enzyme and with the enzyme. What can you tell me about the energy level of reactants without the enzyme and with the enzyme? What is the energy level? Is the energy level of reactants higher? Well, let's take a look at this graph right here. Here is the vertical axis. We have energy, and over here we have energy. And what's the level? It's exactly the same, right? So the energy level of reactants is exactly the same, whether it's a non-catalyzed or catalyzed reaction. Now, what about the product energy level? It's the same as well, okay, between the non-catalyzed and the catalyzed. And so the energy that's released in this particular reaction, and remember, if the products have less free energy compared to the reactants, then that's a negative delta G. That's an exergonic reaction. All right, so how much energy is released by this particular reaction from the non-catalyzed compared to the enzyme-catalyzed reaction? It would be from this level down to here. Would be the energy level of the reactants minus the products, which is what? What color arrow is that? Green? Yellow? Okay, it's that yellow arrow. This isn't a non-catalyzed reaction. The catalyzed reaction, right, the energy change, again, it is exergonic. This is the amount of energy that's released, and again, that should be a nice yellow arrow right there. And what's the size of this yellow arrow between the catalyzed and non-catalyzed reaction? They're exactly the same, right? So the energy that's released by an enzyme catalyzed reaction is the same as the uncatalyzed reaction. The only thing that happens is that the activation energy is reduced so that the reaction can proceed much more quickly when it has the help of an enzyme, right? So it just speeds up the rate of the reaction, but the energy released is still the same because that's a law of thermodynamics, right? We can't create energy. We can only transfer it from one product to another. All right, so that's an important consideration. This diagram is real important because it shows you the importance of the structure or the shape of the active site, how it has to match up to the substrates in order for the reaction to proceed. All right, and if the active site changes somehow by changing the temperature or pH or salt concentration of the solution that this enzyme is in, then it changes the active site. And if the active site changes shape, what cannot form? The enzyme-substrate complex cannot form, and if the enzyme-substrate complex can't form, then certainly the products cannot form, and the reaction is inhibited. So this is a pretty important diagram to know. Let's see, we talked about some enzymes, like a kinase. What does a kinase do? It adds a phosphate to another molecule, and a phosphatase removes a phosphate, and not just a phosphate atom, but an inorganic phosphate molecule, which has some oxygens and protons on it as well. All right, then we talked about some cofactors and coenzymes. And of these two right here, which one is the large molecule, the large organic molecule? It's the coenzyme. So a coenzyme sort of looks like this enzyme right here. It's a very large organic molecule. And a cofactor is just a small metal ion that might associate itself with a substrate, or maybe it will bind to the enzyme, changing the shape of the enzyme or changing the shape of a substrate, which then changes the enzymatic activity. Okay. Here's another important concept, law of mass action, otherwise known as Le Chatelier's principle. And it just says that if the free energy of the reactants is similar to the free energy of the products, then this reaction can go backwards and forwards. It's a bidirectional reaction. And it will proceed in one direction or the other based on the concentration of all the participants in the reaction. So if we take carbonic acid away from this system, which way is this reaction going to move? If we remove carbonic acid, then water and carbon dioxide will combine to replace some of that carbonic acid that has been removed from this particular system, right? Or if we add water, that will force the reaction to the right. So if we remove the product or if we add reactants, that will force the reaction to the right. If we add products, that will force the reaction to the left. Or if we remove some of these reactants. If we remove reactants, that will force the reaction to the left. That's going to be important to see that. And you should know the name of the enzyme that catalyzes that reaction. I took it off the screen. It's nasty of me to do that. But who knows what the name of that enzyme is that's doing that? Carbonic anhydrase. That's right. Carbonic anhydrase can take water and CO2 and make carbonic acid out of it. And that's going to actually make another compound for us that we're going to look at later on in this chapter. All right, let's talk about ATP. This ATP right here, does it look like an organic compound or a metal ion or what? Is it big or small? It's big. Look at all these atoms in here. There's nitrogen and carbons and oxygen and even phosphorus over here. All right, so this is a very large organic molecule, and it is used for carrying things around inside the cell, and what it carries is energy in the form of a chemical bond. So we call this adenosine triphosphate because the nucleotide is adenosine, and you can see that there are three phosphates, so hence the name triphosphate. And this bond is a relatively high energy bond. And of all the bonds that you know, what form of bond is the strongest in general? A covalent bond, right? And this is in particular a strong covalent bond. So in order to make this bond, it's going to require a lot of energy, right? To add this third phosphate to adenosine diphosphate, that's going to require a lot of energy. That would be an endergonic reaction. But that energy is stored in this bond so that when this terminal phosphate group is hydrolyzed from ATP, then that energy that's in this bond is released to work other kinds of chemical reactions that are endergonic as well. So going from ATP to ADP, that's a highly exorganic reaction, and that can be coupled with unfavorable endergonic reactions in your body, but ones that nonetheless are necessary to sustain your life. Okay, so how do we make ATP? We take adenosine diphosphate, these two phosphates right here, and an inorganic phosphate. Remember, inorganic phosphate is a PO4 group. It's not just a phosphate. And then that can be put together and make ATP out of it. But there's something that's not on this diagram, and you should probably put it on this diagram, and that is energy. Where would you want to put energy in this illustration? Should you put it up here by the reactants, or should you put it down here by the product? Okay, the energy is in ATP in the form of this bond, so that when this bond is broken and ATP goes to inorganic phosphate, adenosine diphosphate, I also want you to put a little plus right here and put energy. Okay, and so if you have energy up over here, going from ATP to ADP, that is an exorganic reaction. Going from ADP to ATP, that's an endergonic reaction. So that has to be coupled to some other kind of exergonic reaction in order to make ATP. And that's going to be the focus of the next chapter. All right, so you could consider ATP as being a coenzyme in a number of chemical reactions because it's donating energy to that system. So if you want to think of it as a coenzyme, that's fine with me. All right, let's talk about a class of chemical reactions. These are called oxidation-reduction reactions. And it has to do with electrons. And another way of thinking of it is with the movement of protons or hydrogen ions. You could think of it in either way. I'd like to think of it in terms of electrons. And I'll point that out to you during the lecture. All right, and because that's the basic definition of an oxidation-reduction reaction. Oxidation reactions can only happen in the company of a reduction reaction. They always work together. You cannot have one without the other. So if you have a compound that's being oxidized, what happens to some other part of a reactant in this this chemical reaction? It has to become reduced, right? So you have to have a number of different molecules. If one is oxidized, then another one has to be reduced. So if a molecule gains electrons, we say it is reduced. You're going to have to look at this definition a number of times so that it kind of sinks in and you become familiar with it. All right. So that also means that if electrons come from someplace to join this molecule right here, so the molecule gains electrons and becomes reduced, that also means that some other molecule has to give them up. That's just the way it goes. And when a compound loses electrons, it becomes oxidized. So that's why reduction reactions are always coupled to oxidation. You can't not cannot have one without the other. All right, so a reducing agent is some kind of compound that donates electrons. A reducing agent will reduce another compound by donating its electrons to that particular compound. And an oxidizing agent will accept electrons from another compound. And when it accepts electrons, guess what happens to an oxidizing agent? It becomes reduced. So this sounds like kind of like a riddle the first time you hear it, right? So you got to just sit down and think about it, and probably one day it won't work. You have to think about it a number of times before you become familiar with this. And I'll try to point this out to you. All right, so reduction and oxidation reactions are always coupled reactions. Often involve transfer of protons instead of electrons. So here's like a dual way for you to think of it. I like to think of it in terms of electrons, at least the way I present the lectures in here. Right? There are some coenzymes that play important roles as proton carriers or electron carriers. These are NAD and FAD. Right? And for NAD, you probably don't have to know what that stands for, but that's nicotinamide dinucleotide. Have you heard of a nucleotide before? They have for the building block of nucleic acids, and also ATP is a nucleotide. All right, so you're going to see a familiar kind of structure right here. But whenever you see NAD, you should put a plus sign. It has a charge. It has an electrical charge on it. Anytime you see NAD, your book is really bad about doing that. Okay, put a plus sign by it. All right, FAD is a similar kind of compound. It's also a vitamin. All right, it's a coenzyme, so it's a large organic molecule, and it can accept electrons as well and protons. So it's kind of like a cousin molecule to NAD. And FAD by itself is a neutral molecule. You don't want to put a plus sign there. And when it becomes reduced, we're going to see what that produces. It also produces a neutral molecule. Okay. These are also vitamins, vitamin B type vitamins. All right, so here are pictures, diagrams of the two molecules, and I might have to turn the lights off for you to see them, but hopefully you have them printed out. Okay, here is NAD, as a matter of fact, I can hardly see that. Here is NAD plus. All right, so here is a ribose sugar. Right, and then a base here and a base here. That's why we call this a dinucleotide, because just two nucleotides joined together. It looks like a short segment of like DNA or something with this bond between the phosphate groups. Right, and it just so happens that NAD plus, this nitrogen in the base right here, has a plus sign. That's what that little dot right there represents. So this overall molecule has a plus sign. So if it has a plus sign right here, if it's an ion, what is it looking for? What is its natural tendency? To look for an electron to neutralize that charge, right? And when there is a compound that wants to donate electrons to NAD, okay, it will gladly accept them. And as a matter of fact, it will accept two electrons, and they end up by the nitrogen group, And then also a hydrogen group is added to this ring structure, and it also produces a hydrogen ion in solution, increases the acidity of the solution. So when we add electrons to NAD+, it becomes NADH. This H doesn't count because it's just floating in solution, so it becomes NADH. So NAD+ gets converted to NADH, and NADH has accepted electrons, so it has become reduced. So NADH is the reduced form of NAD. NAD+ is the oxidized form. And to go from the oxidized to the reduced form, what do we have to add to NAD+? Some electrons, okay, to reduce it into the form of NADH. And as a matter of fact, how many electrons are added to NAD+? There are two dots right here. And these electrons are high-energy electrons. So NADH is not only carrying electrons, but it's carrying energy from one set of chemical reactions to another in the form of these high-energy electrons. All right, so that's NAD+. Here's FAD, a little bit different molecule. It's a vitamin. Okay, could you say, by looking at this formula right here, could you say if that was a cofactor or a coenzyme? Coenzyme, because it's a very large organic molecule, right? It's not a cofactor because it's not a metal ion. And okay, so FAD is the oxidized form. It can accept two electrons as long as there's a molecule that wants to give up two electrons, and they're placed in this ring structure over here. And two hydrogens are also added. And if we think of the nucleus of a hydrogen atom, what's the charge of the nucleus of a hydrogen atom? Oh, I don't have a periodic table right here. Nasty of me. But it's the first one. It has one, right? It has one proton inside the nucleus. So if we add two electrons and two protons to FAD, it doesn't change the charge of it at all, right? Because then it's neutral. But it carries the energy of those electrons in this ring structure right here, and FADH2, because it adds two protons, can carry that energy from one set of metabolic reactions to another. Okay, so these are what we use to carry high energy around inside of our cells in the form of these electrons. Okay, so the thing you should remember, FAD is the oxidized form, FADH2 is the reduced form, and since it's the reduced form, what is it really carrying? High energy electrons that can be used to do work. Okay. Well, I'd like to keep that slide on the screen for the next chapter, but I can't. I don't know how to do that. All right, so that is the end of this chapter, and we're going to move on to the next chapter, which is chapter 5, cell respiration and metabolism. So let me boot it up right here. Okay, how am I doing? Am I doing it in order? I hear some talking. I think this is the next one. Did I get it in the right order? Yeah, it is the next one. Cell respiration and metabolism. All right, well, we defined what metabolism is, I think. No, we talked about what a metabolic pathway is. Metabolic pathway is when we have a number of conversion steps of one reactant into a product, and that product is converted into another product, and that's then further converted into another one on down the line. So it's a number of enzymatically controlled chemical reactions. Okay. So the kinds of reactions that we're going to look at in this chapter, not all of them in this chapter, but at least these three right here, glycolysis, aerobic respiration, and fat and protein metabolism. Okay, just give you a little bit of an overview of some of these things. That's why we have a week and a half to talk about all of this. Okay, so metabolism is just defined as all the reactions in the body that involve energy transformations. And they can be divided into two categories, depending on which way this energy flows. We call it catabolism, okay, if molecules are broken down and it releases energy. And this is the primary source of energy for making ATP. So catabolism is what? Exorganic or endorganic? It's exergonic because it releases energy. And if it's releasing energy, then that energy can be used to take an inorganic phosphate and combine it with an ADP to make an ATP out of it. And then that energy has been incorporated into the ATP molecule. And ATP is the universal energy currency inside your cells. So for instance, you might have some valuable in your pocket, or you might be wearing some valuables around your wrist, like a watch or something, so it has inherent value. But if you go to the grocery store and try to buy some food with your wristwatch, even though it's very valuable, can you do that? No, you can't. You need the currency that we're using here, which, okay, is the dollar. And so what ATP is the dollar inside the cell. There might be other forms of energy, but this is the one in the form of ATP that can be used mostly in the cell. Okay, so catabolism breaks down molecules and is exergonic, releases energy, and that energy can be used to make ATP, and then ATP can be distributed around in the cell for the cell's purposes. Anabolism, on the other hand, is when we take a large molecule, a lot of covalent bonds, and break those covalent bonds. When we take large molecules, we break those covalent bonds, that requires energy. All right, so this is the source of the body's large energy store of compounds, like, for instance, lipids and things like that are large molecules. Another good example would be glycogen, which is a storage form of glucose. And glycogen is similar to a molecule that plants make, but in plants we call it starch. So the basic building block of starch is glucose. The basic building block of glycogen is glucose. The form is a little bit different. Glycogen is a little bit more branched on how you put all the glucoses together. All right, so catabolism breaks down molecules, releases energy. Anabolism makes larger ones, but in order to take small ones to make a larger one out of it, it requires energy for that to happen. So here is a pretty interesting slide, and this is an extra credit drawing for you guys in lab that I sent out over the weekend. If you didn't get that email, then you got to talk to me, or you don't have to talk to me, but you have to go into Blackboard and make sure that you have a valid email address that is doesn't get spammed into some spam folder when you check your emails. Okay, and on this slide, I see a couple different compartments. Okay, and a couple different processes happening. All right, I see glucose, which is going to be our base energy molecule, and that's what we have in our diet. This is how we get energy into our body. So when we have a meal, that glucose enters the digestive system, and that glucose then is absorbed and put into the bloodstream. So this red area right here just represents the blood or plasma. Okay, when somebody has eaten a meal, this state where you're absorbing glucose from the food that you eat and blood glucose increases as a result of that, right? If glucose goes from your digestive tract into your blood, then your blood glucose is going to increase. This state is what we call the fed state, F-E-D, fed, because you have been feeding. Okay? So fed state, so put fed right up over here. All right, so how is blood glucose maintained when you're in the fed state? When you're in the fed state, glucose goes from your GI tract into the blood and maintains blood glucose. Okay? And that will increase blood glucose. Now, when you're in the state over here, when you haven't eaten anything, and when is the period of time when you haven't eaten for the longest period? Like when you're fasting, when do you fast? Usually all night long when I'm sleeping, at least as far as I know. No one ever told me that I sleepwalk, but that sounds like a good idea. Okay? So all night long, you're fasted, so this is a fasted state. And when you're in a fasted state, then of course you don't have any glucose in the GI tract to put into the blood. So what happens to blood glucose levels then, would you expect? They would start to decrease. But, okay, they don't decrease too much if you have normal homeostatic control, because there is a compound in the liver, which you have in you, even when you're sleeping, and that is called glycogen. And what's the building block of glycogen? It is glucose. So when you're in a fasted state, so here's the second state is fasted. So over here you have the fed state. Over here you have the fasted state. And then when you're in homeostasis, your blood glucose should not go up and down wildly, even when you're in the fasted state, because glycogen can be broken down into glucose. And the liver is a nice altruistic organism. Organ. It's the only organ in your body that will actually release glucose back to the rest of the body. Every other organ, once it receives glucose, it will just hold on to it and never give it up to any other organ in your body. But the liver will do that. So the liver, when it gets a signal that blood glucose is decreasing, will break down glycogen into glucose. And when glucose goes from the liver into the blood, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes back up, right, to maintain nice homeostasis. Okay, so those are the two states, maintaining glucose. All right, so what do we do with glucose? Glucose moves out of the blood, right, down its concentration gradient, into tissues. So here is a cell. So this is just cytoplasm. This represents cytoplasm. Kind of looks like a beige background to me. Okay. So now we have glucose in the cell cytoplasm. And the first process that we have right here is called glycolysis. Now, what do you know about this word lysis? What does that mean? Yeah, to break apart. So inside the cell, it takes a glucose molecule, grabs a pair of scissors, and chops it in half. How many carbons are in a glucose molecule? There are six. And if it's chopped in half, then what do you have? You have two molecules that have three carbons on them. And that molecule is what we call pyruvic acid. And another name for pyruvic acid is pyruvate. Those are exactly the same compounds. And the process that takes glucose and chops it down to pyruvate is called glycolysis. And where in the cell does that take place? Cytoplasm. That's why this is such a cool slide, because it has a lot of good information on it. All right, so glycolysis is taking glucose to pyruvate. Glucose is a big molecule. Pyruvic acid is a small one. So what is happening here? Glucose to pyruvate. And as a matter of fact, if you want to put two pyruvic acids, you can. That's fine with me. So if you're going from a big molecule to two small molecules, is that catabolism or anabolism? That's catabolism. And is that exergonic or endergonic? It's exergonic, right? Catabolism is exergonic. It releases energy. What did we say about chemical reactions that can release energy? Then your body can take that energy and make ATP out of it. Okay, so that's what we're going to get to on this particular slide. All right, so glucose to pyruvate is exergonic. Now we have two, three carbon atoms. Now, depending on the state of this cell, there can be two possible fates for pyruvic acid or pyruvate. I see one arrow here, and I see one arrow moving off to the right. It all depends on the state of oxygen inside these cells. All right, so hopefully all of your cells are nicely oxygenated because you're inhaling and exhaling. I see everybody's eyes open. That's a really good thing. Okay, so if there is oxygen inside the cell, then pyruvic acid will go into the mitochondria. It has a way to get inside the mitochondria. And you know what a mitochondria looks like? Yeah, it's a double membrane, kind of looks like a bean inside the cell. It's got some crusty membranes, special folds of membranes inside the mitochondria. All right, so if there's oxygen inside the cell, pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria and participate in some other chemical reactions. It can enter, well, there's a preparatory reaction. You might want to just put down preparatory reaction because we're going to talk about it. Then after the preparatory reaction, there are some intermediates that can enter the Krebs cycle. And you see the cycle is just a repeating cycle over and over and over again. Okay, how many carbons does pyruvic acid have? Pyruvic acid is, you get two pyruvates for one glucose. Glucose has six, so if you chop glucose in half, that's three. And under aerobic conditions, it can enter the mitochondria. This preparatory reaction will chop one carbon off of pyruvic acid to form a two-carbon fragment called an acetyl group. And that one carbon that gets broken off of pyruvic acid becomes a carbon dioxide. Because how many carbons does carbon dioxide have? It's got one carbon and two oxygens. That's why we call it carbon dioxide. All right, and then what does your body do with that carbon dioxide that's produced by this preparatory reaction? You exhale that out of your body. Okay. So we got two carbons left. Those two carbons enter the Krebs cycle, and those two carbons then are split apart. So again, that's another catabolic reaction. Right? This one right here, since a carbon is chopped off of pyruvate, right, that's a catabolic reaction. There's extra energy. And that extra energy is used to run your cell. We're going to see that it's going to be converted into ATP. Here's the Krebs cycle. The Krebs cycle produces two CO2s. That's going to be important to know. All right, so what organelle inside your body produces CO2 that we have to exhale? Okay, the lungs excrete it from our bodies, get rid of carbon dioxide from our bodies, but that's an organ. But what organelle inside your cell is responsible for producing all those CO2s from glucose? It's the mitochondria. So you're going to have to get that kind of settled in your mind right there. Okay, and what do you know about the mitochondria? The most important thing about this slide was never put on this slide. What do you know about mitochondria? What does it do for us? It makes ATP. So if I ever ask you, what's the most important thing about this slide right here, you should say is the production of ATP. And we're going to see where that happens. Okay, through the rest of the chapter. Okay, so the preparatory reaction produces CO2, the Krebs cycle produces CO2, and some high energy electrons are produced by this preparatory reaction and also by glycolysis and also by the Krebs cycle. Those high energy electrons then are transferred to the electron transport chain. And this happens under what kind of conditions? Aerobic conditions. If oxygen is present, then it can happen. And remember, those electrons have a high energy associated with it. When they hop from one molecule to another, they release that energy. So that's, again, another series of exergonic reactions. And when a molecule accepts an electron, what do we call that kind of reaction? When it accepts an electron, that is called a reduction reaction. So when a molecule donates electrons, then that molecule becomes oxidized, and whoever accepts those electrons becomes reduced. So there's a series of oxidation reduction reactions in electron transport, and those electrons give up energy. Well, we're going to see how your cell makes ATP out of that. So those electrons go all the way down through electron transport chain, and they combine with another molecule that we have to actually breathe in to our body. What do we need? So we breathe out to get rid of CO2 from the prep reaction and the Krebs cycle. We breathe in oxygen, so oxygen has to enter the mitochondria, right, because this is aerobic respiration. As a matter of fact, pyruvic acid cannot even enter the mitochondria unless it has oxygen, which is the reason why we inhale. So we have oxygen, and oxygen loves to accept those electrons from the electron transport chain, and when it does, it produces water. Okay, I don't like the CO2. CO2 is actually produced by the Krebs cycle and the prep reaction. But oxygen and electrons and some protons through those oxidation reduction reactions produce water. So the reason why we inhale is to keep electrons moving through the electron transport chain. And without oxygen as the final electron acceptor, electrons cannot move through the electron transport chain. And we're going to see that when electrons move through the ETC, I'm just going to call this ETC from now on, electron transport chain, that's what is producing the majority of ATP for us in our cells. So what are the necessary conditions to make ATP efficiently in our cells? You need oxygen. You need aerobic respiration. Okay. All right, so there's one other step, which I'll go back and do, and that is pyruvic acid. I said there are two possible fates for it. If oxygen is present, it can enter the mitochondria and produce gobs of ATP for us. But under anaerobic conditions, conditions where oxygen is not in high concentration in the cytoplasm, then pyruvic acid, since it can't get in the mitochondria, will start to build up inside the cell. And as pyruvic and other compounds build up inside the cytoplasm, and if pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell, then that's going to force the reaction to make glucose. Okay, it's going to force it in the reverse direction due to Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. All right, and if pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell, that will stop glycolysis. And that's an exergonic reaction, so the cell cannot make ATP under those conditions. So to keep glycolysis working, the cell has to get rid of pyruvic acid, and it does so by making lactic acid. Pyruvic acid cannot leave the cell, but it's converted into lactic acid, and then lactic acid can leave the cell, and that gets rid of the pyruvic acid, so glycolysis can proceed and make some ATP for us. All right, so what is really the take-home message with this slide right here? What is it really doing? Is the important thing about this slide right here making water? Making CO2? Using up oxygen? No. What is the most important thing about this slide? Making ATP, and now we got to figure out where that ATP is made with these different reactions. So the reactions that you should kind of outline in your mind is glucose converted to pyruvic acid. That's one. We call that glycolysis. All right. With oxygen present, then pyruvic acid is converted into an acetyl group. That's what we call the preparatory reaction. And then another set of reactions right here is the Krebs cycle that breaks down that acetyl group completely into carbon dioxide, but it produces high energy electrons for the electron transport chain, which then is used to make gobs of ATP. The last one is this anaerobic reaction where pyruvate is used to make lactic acid. Lactic acid is removed from the cell, and that then reduces the level of pyruvic acid inside the cell so that glycolysis can stay operating in the forward direction, so it doesn't go in the reverse direction. All right, so let's look at some of these reactions. The first one is glycolysis, which is what? What's a good way to think of glycolysis? Splitting of glucose, right, into 2-3 carbons, and that's catabolism, taking a large molecule, making it into 2 small molecules. Is that exergonic or endorgonic? That's exergonic, right? Okay, so here is a synopsis of glycolysis. Right, so it's the metabolic pathway by which glucose is converted into 2 pyruvates. Right, does not require oxygen. Something else you should put on this slide is that it happens in the cytoplasm. It is, or in the cytosol. It does not happen inside the mitochondria. The overall net reaction is as follows. You have glucose, right? That's what's in our diet. That's what we need to take into our bodies. Then we have NAD, and what did I say about NAD? You should also put some pluses right here. So you got 2 NAD pluses. And then you have ADP, 2 inorganic phosphates. If we split glucose in half, we get 2 pyruvates or 2 pyruvic acids. But then something changes right here. This ADP and inorganic phosphate is converted into ATP. Is that a good thing? Yeah, that's the currency inside your cell. All right. But it also produces some high-energy electrons, and those high-energy electrons are used to reduce NAD plus into NADH. All right, so NADH is carrying those high-energy electrons, and later on we're going to see that those high-energy electrons can be used to make ATP with another metabolic pathway. But glycolysis by itself can make ATP. How many ATPs can be made by glycolysis for every glucose molecule? 2. Okay, that's not very impressive. That's better than nothing. But 2 is better than nothing, but 2 is not a big number. All right, so glycolysis can be important for some organs that aren't highly metabolic, but 2 ATPs will not run your brain. As a matter of fact, if glycolysis is the only thing operating in your brain, you have about 2 or 3 seconds of consciousness, and then your brain runs out of ATP. It's glycolysis is still working, making ATP, and then after a certain period of time, the brain dies because it runs out of ATP and can't run the sodium potassium pumps. How long does somebody have if blood is not reaching their brain and therefore oxygen is not reaching mitochondria? But when does somebody's brain actually die? And remember, death is an irreversible process. Once it dies, it can't come back. 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness. You still can come back because your brain's not dead. But after what period of time? You know what? 2 to 3 minutes as well. Maybe 5 minutes if somebody's doing CPR with you. Maybe longer. All right, so that's the importance of these metabolic pathways that we're talking about to make ATP for us. Okay. Well, just because if somebody's heart stops and you're doing CPR with them, don't stop after 2 or 3 minutes because you think their brain is dead. Especially me. Okay, if my heart stops, you should do CPR on me for 20 or 30 minutes, right, before you give up, because you never really know. Okay, all right, glycolysis is exergonic. We talked about that. It releases a lot of energy, and that energy can be used to combine ADP and inorganic phosphate to make ATPs, and also that energy can be used to reduce NAD plus and produce 2 NADHs. All right, but there's a little something that has to happen first. When glucose enters the cell, it has to become activated. And 2 ATPs are used to activate glycolysis before the energy in glycolysis can be obtained. The phosphorylation of glucose with these ATPs right here traps glucose inside the cell. Because this inorganic phosphate, I have to go back to the previous lecture, but remember that inorganic phosphate has a lot of charged molecules on it. So you have oxygens that have these negative charges, okay? And what can you, and so it's a very polar molecule. That phosphate group is a very polar molecule. And what can you tell me about a molecule that's polar in terms of moving across the cell membrane? It cannot, because the cell membrane is hydrophobic. It's a nonpolar region, and a polar molecule can't go across the membrane. So as soon as glucose becomes phosphorylated, it's trapped inside the cell, unless there's a way for that cell to get rid of the phosphate with a phosphatase enzyme. Okay? So as a matter of fact, you can tell me the name of the enzyme that will phosphorylate glucose. It's a kinase, yeah. And sometimes we describe it as by what kind of action it does. It takes a phosphate, adds it to the sixth carbon, so it's called glucose 6 phosphokinase. Okay, so and that traps glucose inside the cell. So here we have a nice diagram of free energy, right, versus the process of glycolysis through a number of intermediate steps right here, and we don't get too carried away with knowing all the intermediates, but we have glucose inside the cell, right, and if we take ATP, hydrolyze it, and stick that terminal phosphate and glucose, then that glucose receives some of that energy from ATP. So what happens to the energy level of glucose when it goes to glucose 6 phosphate? It has received some of the energy from ATP, so its free energy increases. Okay? And so this is a way of getting what? Over the activation energy barrier is a way to think of that from that previous slide that I showed you. But it doesn't require one ATP. How many ATPs does it require? Another step. So now you have 1,6, okay, there's a diphosphate on the glucose, that's the highest level. Now that glucose molecule is highly energized, and then it can be broken down very efficiently in a number of steps. All right, so this first part of glycolysis, when glucose goes up to here, that is endorganic. It requires energy from ATP, but once it gets up to here, it can go all the way down to pyruvic acid, and going from high energy to low energy is what? An exergonic series of reactions, so that energy is being released, that energy can be used to make some important compounds like ATP right here. Okay, plus also NADH, a reduced form of NAD+. All right, so there's a series of enzymatic reactions. We see one glucose going to this level here, and then glucose is split in half. So every arrow that's going down, there are actually two molecules going down. All right, and up here, all right, there's just one glucose. So that's why we say glycolysis requires two ATP. But since there are two 3-carbon molecules moving down here, we have two steps making two ATPs. Okay, so there are actually four that are being made. And the net reaction is four ATPs minus two. All right, so there we say is what? A net gain of two ATPs. Even though glycolysis produces four, don't forget it takes two to get things going, to get over that activation energy barrier. Okay. Then we also have some NADH that's carrying some high energy electrons. Now, where does this process take place? Where is this NADH located? Where does glycolysis take place inside the cell? In the cytoplasm. Yeah, it's not inside the mitochondria. Electron transport chain, we're going to see, is inside the mitochondria. So this NADH is going to have to enter the mitochondria later on in order to make ATP. That's a little consideration that we have to think about. All right. Glycolysis, does it produce CO2? How many carbons are in glucose? 6. How many carbons in pyruvic acid? 3. And glycolysis produces 2 pyruvic acids, so all the carbon atoms are accounted for. So glycolysis does not produce CO2 that we have to exhale from our body. It does produce 2 ATP for us and 2 NADHs, however. All right, so here are the reactions. And I forget, is this an exam figure? Some semesters I have it as an exam figure and some I don't, and I forgot if this is, okay. I think maybe for this semester I don't have it as an exam figure. So you don't have to memorize all these little steps right here. But the take-home message is glucose, you have 6 carbons. Glycolysis is going to split it in half, okay, to produce 2 pyruvic acids. And in so doing, it's going to release energy. This is an exergonic metabolic pathway. That energy can be used to make ATP. So this step right here, from 1,3 biphosphoglycerate to 3 phosphoglyceric acid, there's enough energy released that can produce an ATP from an ADP molecule. All right, so there's a lot of energy released that can be used to make ATP. This is what we call substrate level phosphorylation. When we take an ADP using one enzymatic step to make ATP, this is substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so how many steps can make ATP in glycolysis? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, but don't forget, it takes two to get glycolysis working. So we say that these two net gains of ATP made by glycolysis are done by substrate level phosphorylation. That's another fancy way of saying, when you look at this slide right here, if you look everywhere on this slide, do you see any oxygen? No. Oxygen is not required. Okay, so for most cases of substrate level phosphorylation, oxygen is not required. Okay, the other thing that's made are these two NADHs, which are carrying high energy electrons, because remember, NAD is actually a cation. If you want to draw a little plus right here and a little plus right here, that might help you remember that it accepts high energy electrons because NADH is a neutral molecule. Okay, so that is glycolysis, the things that you have to know about it. It's producing ATP for us, a good thing, a measly too, better than nothing, but for your heart and brain, it's not nearly enough to keep it alive. Maybe a pancreas, or maybe a muscle that's not exercising, it can stay alive. Or maybe some cartilage that doesn't do a whole lot can stay alive with glycolysis. And as a matter of fact, a red blood cell is not highly metabolic either. It gets ATP via glycolysis, and that's the only reaction, because red blood cells don't have mitochondria for aerobic respiration. All right, so we have pyruvic acid right here. And, oops, let me go back. And we said that on that previous slide, under aerobic conditions, pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria. And that will decrease the concentration of pyruvic acid in the cytosol. All right, but under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid builds up inside the cytoplasm. And when you look at this metabolic pathway, you can see down arrows, but what else can you see? You can see up arrows. So if we build up the concentration of pyruvic acid, what's going to happen to glycolysis? It's going to be forced in the reverse direction, okay? And instead of making ATPs, right, then ATPs will not be made. And what do you need to stay alive? ATP. So you got to do something with this pyruvic acid that builds up in the cytoplasm under anaerobic conditions. There's something else that happens too. And that is, in order for glycolysis to work in the forward direction, what can you tell me about NAD plus or NADH for the same reason of pyruvic acid right here? In order to get glycolysis producing ATP in the forward direction, you have to have NAD plus available for the reaction to run. And the other thing is, you can't have NADH build up because that's going to make glycolysis work in the reverse direction. Okay? Because of Le Chatelier's principle. So in order for glycolysis to work under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid has to be reduced inside the cytoplasm, NADH has to be converted back to NAD so that glycolysis can work in the forward direction. So we have a nice lactic acid pathway that does that for us in our cells. Other organisms do it in other ways. Okay, so other organisms do it in a decarboxylation reaction. That's probably everybody's favorite reaction in here. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? I'll draw it on the board in just a little bit. Okay, but it's a fermentation reaction. That's a clue. All right, so to avoid end product inhibition, these NADHs produced by glycolysis, you have to deal with them somehow. In the absence of oxygen, NADH gives up its high energy electrons and proteins to pyruvic acid or pyruvate, and thus making lactic acid with this equation right here. So we have pyruvic acid. This is the formula. You don't have to know the formula of pyruvic acid. Okay. And so this is the oxidized form of this three-carbon molecule. When it becomes reduced, it becomes lactic acid, so it acquires some high-energy electrons, but it also acquires some protons as well, so that's why you could think of this as an oxidation reduction reaction as a transfer of protons as well. Right, but I really want you to focus on electrons, but I don't see them on the diagram. I just want you to know that they're there. High energy electrons from NADH get transferred into lactic acid. So since lactic acid has received electrons, is that the oxidized form or the reduced form? That's the reduced form because it has accepted those electrons from NADH. All right, so when NADH gives up its electrons, what happens to it? Does it become oxidized or reduced? Becomes oxidized. So NAD, and draw a nice little plus right here, NAD is the oxidized form of nicotinamide dinucleotide. NADH is the reduced form. All right, and what is this NAD plus good for in the cytoplasm? Let's go back. You need it to make glycolysis work in the forward direction, to make ATP. So if NADH builds up inside the cell, remember, glycolysis is inhibited. So glycolysis is disinhibited by this reaction right here because it gets rid of NADH, also gets rid of pyruvic acid for you. So that allows glycolysis, and when glycolysis is able to work, what's being produced? ATP. How many ATPs? Lousy two. Better than nothing, though. Okay, so this is what we call anaerobic respiration or fermentation. When muscles fatigue, right, when a muscle is contracted, it turns into this, what, incredibly hard, rocky structure right there, and blood can't get into a muscle. If blood can't get into a muscle when it's contracted, how much oxygen is getting in there? None. Okay, so anaerobic respiration takes over. Right, pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid when muscles are working strongly because blood can't get into them. And as a matter of fact, that produces a sensation. Have you ever been walking down the sidewalk and all of a sudden a muscle goes into contracture, goes into tetanus and it just contracts? Like if my biceps right now went into tetanus and contracted, would I be walking around the room just showing that big muscle off, being really proud of it, or what would I be doing? I would be dancing around, I'd be doing anything to get that muscle to relax because, sometimes we call that a Charlie horse, how does it feel? Well, it hurts like hell, okay? When that muscle is exercising, does not have oxygen, producing all this lactic acid, all right, it's very, very painful, okay? And that's what happens when somebody has a heart attack as well, or when they have a muscle in their body that goes into spasm, it just hurts really, really bad. As a matter of fact, somebody that's having a heart attack will feel so bad that they think they're going to die, and they die as a result of that impression that they have. Right? If it can get them to the hospital, right, then they might be just fine. Okay, because it just hurts like hell. Okay, so lactic acid then replenishes or gets rid of pyruvic acid. All right, so that means then that glycolysis produces only 2 ATPs for every glucose under anaerobic conditions. Red blood cells don't have mitochondria. They do not have organelles because they're loaded with a chemical that transports oxygen in our body. That's hemoglobin. There's no room for anything else inside a red blood cell. There's no nucleus or anything like that. All right, so that's how red blood cells make ATP, is by glycolysis. And glycolysis can occur in skeletal muscle and heart muscle when oxygen levels fall below a critical level. But if the heart and brain is not revascularized, then the heart and brain cannot sustain life. Okay, maybe a skeletal muscle can if it stops working. Okay, let's talk about a couple other terms right here. Glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. What does genesis mean? Oh, I tell you what, before we get to there, what does glyco stand for? Glyco stands for sugar or glucose. Okay, and I see it in both of these terms. So both of these terms have to do with glucose metabolism. And genesis means the creation of, right? The creation of these sugar molecules. And glycogenolysis is what? The breakdown of complex sugar molecules. All right, so a cell would like to store a lot of glucose. But as we start adding glucose molecule solution, what happens to that solution in terms of tonicity? It becomes hypertonic. When it becomes hypertonic, as the concentration of solutes inside the cell increases, then that cell is going to start to absorb water. What happens to the cell? It's going to start to swell up and then eventually break. So your cells can't store millions of molecules of glucose as individual molecules because they would all swell up and burst. So what cells do is take all those thousands of molecules and create one molecule out of it, and that one molecule doesn't force water to rush into the cell. So glucose is converted into glycogen. The basic building block of glycogen is glucose. The process of taking glucose and making glycogen out of it is called glycogenesis. So as a matter of fact, you want to be able to pronounce that term, and you want to have your reading glasses so that you can see this term on a test or whatever to make sure that you're not reading glycogenolysis or other kinds of terms that are very similar. All right, so glycogenesis is the conversion of glucose into glycogen. So you're taking many particles of glucose and making one glycogen molecule out of it that it has no osmotic properties inside the cell, but it's still storing all the energy in all those glucoses. Okay. Skeletal muscle and liver stores a lot of glycogen because they're highly metabolic. Our brain really doesn't. And why does a liver store glycogen? Because that goes all the way back to that first slide. When you're in a fasted state and your blood glucose levels start to drop, the liver then is told to take that glycogen and split it up into glucose, and that glucose can enter the blood, maintaining your blood glucose levels when you're in a fasted state under normal conditions. Okay, and that process is what we call glycogenolysis, when a liver will go and chop a glucose off. So it clips a glucose out of glycogen as glucose 6-phosphate. So there's one phosphate group, okay, on the glucose when glycogen is broken down. And if it's in a muscle cell, that glucose is trapped inside the cell because it has a phosphate. The liver, on the other hand, has glucose 6-phosphatase, which can take that phosphate off of glucose 6-phosphate, and now the liver can export that glucose into the bloodstream because it has a glucose 6-phosphatase. Here are some enzymatic pathways that I want you to know, and we're going to add one to this list. All right, and this is why you got to make sure that you have your reading glasses and that you can read these terms, because we're going to talk about glycolysis, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, and gluconeogenesis. They sound familiar, but they're drastically different kinds of processes, and you got to be a little familiar with what these things are doing. But you already know what some of these things are. Like glycolysis, what is that? That's the conversion of glucose into two pyruvate molecules, right? 2-3 carbons. That's glycolysis. Glycogenesis, on the other hand, is the reverse of glycolysis. You can take 2-pyruvate, right? And you can make glucose out of it. So, glycogenesis is the making of glycogen. Glycogen, the making of glycogen. When an organ takes glucose, adds glucoses together to make glycogen. Glycogenesis. All right, I got to put on my glasses. Glycogenolysis. Okay, so here is glycogen, and glycogen is being broken down. What is glycogen broken down into? Into glucose, right? So glycogenolysis is taking glycogen, breaking it down into glucose. You end up with glucose 6-phosphate. Okay, or free glucose if the liver is doing that process. All right, so we got glycolysis, breaking glucose down. Glycogenesis is the making of new glycogen. Glycogenolysis is the breaking down of glycogen. Okay, and the last term that we haven't talked about yet is gluconeogenesis. Oh, what does neo mean? New. The making, so genesis is the making of new glucose. Okay, and new glucose is something different than what we find in glycogen. It's when we take a 3-carbon molecule, join those 2 3-carbon molecules together to make glucose out of it. For instance, if we run glycolysis in the reverse direction, that's what we call gluconeogenesis, because it's taking pyruvate and making glucose out of it. All right, that requires some energy to do that. All right, so these four terms are grouped together. They all involve glucose and glycogen, and some of these, like gluconeogenesis, require pyruvate as well. Lipogenesis. What can you tell me about lipo right here? Okay, that's a lipid. Okay, and a good lipid that I want you to think of is a triglyceride, not necessarily a fatty acid, but a triglyceride. And the production of triglycerides from 3 fatty acids and glycerol is what we call lipogenesis. Or you could take a triglyceride and break it down. Well, what kind of reaction would be used to break triglyceride down into its building blocks? Hydrolysis reaction. All right, so if you take a triglyceride, break it down with hydrolysis reaction, what are the products? 1 glycerol and 3 fatty acids. All right. Okay, so that's what we call lipolysis. The breakdown of triglycerides is lipolysis. The making of triglycerides is lipogenesis. There's one other term that I want you to write down someplace in the middle, right there. Let's see if this marker works. Oh, I see another one down there. There's something called beta oxidation. And that's a Greek letter, beta, right here. If you want to write it as a B, that's fine. Beta oxidation is a set of chemical reactions that can take a fatty acid, and you should know what a fatty acid looks like, and it's going to break it down into a whole bunch of two carbon atoms. And we call that an acetyl group. So it's a carbon-carbon. And a fatty acid is what kind of molecule? One carbon? Two carbons? Three carbons? Four carbons, five carbons, six carbons, seven, right? Could be 18 or 20, maybe 22. So it's a big, long hydrocarbon chain. And what beta oxidation does is chops off two at a time. And when it does so, it's going to release energy, because that's a catabolic reaction, right? Going from a big molecule to a small molecule is exergonic. That releases energy to make ATP. Furthermore, this acetyl group right here can be used by the Krebs cycle to make even more ATP. All right, so in this list, maybe right after lipolysis, I want you to put down beta oxidation. Beta oxidation breaks down what compound? Fatty acids, okay? While lipolysis does what? It produces fatty acids by breaking down a triglyceride. So there's a little bit of a difference between them, and you got some questions in the back of the book. So beta oxidation is this. What's lipolysis? Lipolysis is a triglyceride, two, three fatty acids plus a glycerol. So there's a little bit of difference between beta oxidation and lipolysis. That will probably help you answer some questions. Okay, write that down in your book. Ketogenesis is just a production of ketone bodies. I don't know how much time we're going to have to talk about that. So maybe I would delete that one from the list. And the sign-in sheet is going around someplace. I already passed it out, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Okay, so this slide right here is going to incorporate glycolysis, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, and gluconeogenesis into a nice working format for you to understand. Okay, so we're going to look at glycogenesis and glycogenolysis and all those other metabolic pathways. All right, so here we have a cell. And there's glucose-6-phosphate inside the cell. And this particular cell has an enzyme, okay, that can dephosphorylate glucose-6-phosphate. And the name of that enzyme is glucose-6-phosphatase. We'll dephosphorylate it. Then we have free glucose, so there's going to be an inorganic phosphate then floating around in the cytoplasm. Okay, and that glucose now can be released to the blood. The only organ that can do that is the liver, because only the liver has glucose-6-phosphatase. So the liver is responsible for maintaining blood glucose when you're in the fasted state, when you're not absorbing glucose from your GI tract. All right, some other possible fates for glucose-6-phosphate. It can enter glycolysis, and when it enters glycolysis, what happens? It produces two ATPs for this particular cell and some pyruvate molecules. Right, that glucose-6-phosphate can be converted to glucose-1-phosphate, just a little bit of a rearrangement. And then that glucose-1-phosphate can be added to a growing glycogen molecule. All right, so what do we call this reaction? Okay, going from glucose to glycogen. That's glycogenesis, right? And that happens when you're in a fed state. Okay, when your blood glucose is normal, okay, the liver will take glucose and convert it into glycogen via glycogenesis. Then when you're in a fasted state, your blood glucose is going to go down. The liver will be told what to do by the pancreas, right? And the liver then is going to convert glycogen into glucose. And so what would you call number two? Glycogen autolysis, the breaking down of glycogen into glucose. And since this is the liver, okay, it can take that phosphate off and put it into the blood. Okay, in all other tissues, when glucose enters the cell, it is phosphorylated and ATP is used up. It's phosphorylated, and that phosphate group is a highly polar group, and it cannot penetrate through the cell membrane right here. So once glucose enters many tissues, it's trapped once it's phosphorylated. What would be the name of the enzyme that takes glucose and phosphorylates it? That's a kinase, and the name of that enzyme is called glucose kinase. Pretty nice and simple, glucose kinase. All right, but right here we see glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. Okay, so let's add some other important pathways. This probably is going to be the last slide we get to talk about today. It's the Cori cycle. And the Cori cycle requires a couple of organs, skeletal muscles and the liver. And skeletal muscles are connected to the liver. What connects skeletal muscle and liver? A connective tissue, namely the blood, because blood can flow from one organ to another, right? And blood is a connective tissue from your anatomy. So we see muscle cells here, we see liver cells over here, and in between we see blood that is flowing between these two different kinds of cells. Okay, so in the blood we have glucose that enters the cell in a skeletal muscle cell, and what is a skeletal muscle cell going to do? It's going to say, thank you, blood. I like that glucose. I'm never going to give it up to anybody else. I want that glucose all for myself. So I'm going to phosphorylate it with glucose kinase. So glucose becomes phosphorylated, and it's trapped inside the cell. So you have two possible fates for this glucose 6-phosphate. If the energy demands of the cell are high or there's low ATP, then glucose 6-phosphate gets converted to pyruvic acid. Right, and what do we call this pathway, number two? Glucose 6-phosphate to pyruvic acid, that's glycolysis, so number two is glycolysis, and in so doing, what is this cell producing? Two ATPs, two measly ATPs. Okay, and then if oxygen is not present, then pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid. Pyruvic acid can't leave the cell, but lactic acid can. All right, so it's going to go into the blood, and then when pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid, that keeps glycolysis open because that gets rid of end product inhibition. That also regenerates NAD+ from NADH. All right, so that's one possible fate for glucose 6-phosphate inside the cell. When the energy demands are high, right, glycolysis is operational. But if the energy demands of the cell are low, like if this is a resting muscle, what happens to that glucose 6-phosphate? It gets incorporated into glycogen instead. It's not used to make ATP because the cell doesn't need a lot of ATP. It's converted to glycogen. What do we call converting glucose 6-phosphate into glycogen? That is glycogenesis. All right, so number nine is under resting conditions, glycogenesis. But if this muscle starts to work again and needs ATP, it can go to glycogen to get glucose so that it can make some ATP from glycolysis. What do you call the pathway of glycogen going to glucose 6-phosphate? Glycogenolysis, the lysis of glycogen into glucose. So number one is glycogenolysis. I know you're going to have to really put on your reading glasses and say those words out loud. Spell them on a piece of paper so that they don't seem so mysterious and complicated. Okay? Because if you're working in a hospital, working in a lab, those words have to be on the tip of your tongue, okay, and you have to understand what they mean. All right, so if a muscle is working, glycogen is going to be converted into glucose, right, and then glycolysis is going to convert that glucose to pyruvic acid, and then furthermore, under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid goes into the blood, and once it's in the blood, where does it go? Where does that lactic acid go once it's in the blood? Everywhere in the body, in particular the liver. So the liver takes up lactic acid. There are three carbons in lactic acid. With that same lactate dehydrogenase reaction, then the liver can convert lactic acid back to pyruvic acid. And then in the liver, it can take two pyruvic acids and recombine it to make glucose. So what do we call, so this was the LDH reaction, lactic acid to pyruvic acid, just working in the reverse direction. That's the LDH reaction. What is the reaction of pyruvic acid being two pyruvates being converted into glucose? That was what we call gluconeogenesis. So when muscles are working really, really hard, then the liver is working really hard, making new glucose out of these pyruvate molecules. All right, so the liver then can then take that glucose and ship it back to this exercising muscle so that that exercising muscle can make a couple of measly ATPs out of it. But if the energy demands of the body then change to where there's plenty of ATP around, then the liver can take that glucose-6-phosphate and make glycogen out of it. What's that called? Glycogenesis. Glycogenesis, okay? And then when this, your body starts to work again, what can the liver do? It can take that glycogen and make glucose out of it. That is what? Glycogenolysis. So this down arrow is glycogenolysis. So make, this is an important exam figure, so make sure you can label these arrows right here. Your text does kind of a lousy job of doing that. So you might have to talk to me or talk to your lab instructor or talk to your SI leader. Your SI leader can do that? Yes, he can. Okay, so make sure that you have those words on the tip of your tongue, and we're going to start with aerobic respiration next time.